Welcome to Simple Living Works, episodes 84 and 85. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, renowned biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann, talking about his recent book, Money and Possessions. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Walter Brueggemann was my guest in 2016, talking about his short devotional book, Sabbath, Resistance to the Culture of Now. His recent scholarly book examines money and possessions throughout the entire Bible. Episode 1 of this two-part series presents his 6 theses about money and possessions in the Bible, observing their contradictory nature to the conventional wisdom and practice of both the ancient world and today's society. Episode 2 is a brief survey of the theme of money and possessions throughout the Bible. Of course, Walter makes some connections between the 6 theses and contemporary politics. The contents, preface, foreword, and introduction, including the 6 theses, are available for free online. The entire 300-page book is fascinating. Those items are essential reading. The link is in the show notes, as is a link to Walter's intriguing biography. The book is, of course, available for purchase at your local independent bookstore and also through interlibrary loan. Walter has been associated with Simple Living Works since it was known as Alternatives. He wrote the biblical reflections for the very first edition of our signature piece, Whose Birthday Is It Anyway?, in 1988. That's our Advent Christmas annual for families, individuals, and congregations. Since then, he has served on Alternatives' Honorary Board of Directors and on the selection committee for our collection of new hymns called Sing Justice, Do Justice, for which he wrote the foreword. Well, Walter, the last time we talked, you said that your new book, Money and Possessions, was going to be your definitive work or your final words on the subject. And so this is just a real pleasure for me to talk to you about money and possessions, not only because I lead an organization around simple living or voluntary simplicity, but also work with the organization that is focused around the Jubilee. And so I think that your book speaks heartily to both of those subjects.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I'm very glad to get to talk with you about it. I don't know whether it's my final word, but it is certainly for now my best shot. And I learned a lot through researching the book, and I'm fairly pleased with how it came out.
Well, now you say in the preface, the purpose of this book is to exhibit the rich, recurring, and diverse references to money and possessions that permeate the Bible. While we might conventionally assume, as we do in practice, that economics is an add-on or a side issue in the biblical text, an inventory of the text, such as I offer here, makes it unmistakably clear that economics is a core preoccupation of the biblical tradition.
Well, I think that's right, and I sort of knew that going in, but even though I had anticipated, I was simply astonished at how economic issues just come up everywhere in the Bible, which led me to think that in many ways our conventional readings of the Bible have sort of missed the boat, and so that was a an important discovery for me in the process of it.
Well, now, you make it very clear in the introduction, that is chapter 1, that we live a material faith, that we tend to over-spiritualize things, particularly money and possessions or the economy, but that the Bible is very serious about being for our lives here and now.
Yes, and I think that's confirmed when you consider that both in our society and in the life of the church, most of the quarrels are about or related to money and the power to control and make decisions about money. So I think that the Bible has it right that economic questions pervade our day-to-day existence, and when the church doesn't face up to that and doesn't recognize it in the Bible, I think we are in some ways supporting an illusion that faith somehow can be in a dimension that is removed from economic matters.
Now, you state six theses in this book, and I don't want this to sound too academic, although this book is definitely scholarly. I mean, it's designed for preachers and teachers and studies, students of the Bible. But these theses, I'd like you to, I'd like us to go through them one at a time and give you all the time you need to talk about each one, because in addition to each thesis, you also present what I would call a counter thesis, that is, how the thesis contradicts our current society, our current economic system. So the first one is that money and possessions are gifts from God. That sounds very obvious, but there's a lot more to it, isn't there?
Well, there is. What that statement reflects is the church's creation theology, or as we say in the creeds of the church, that God has created all that is, and wealth arises basically from the produce of the earth, that is God's gift to us in terms of natural resources that we manage then to utilize and distribute and process in a variety of ways, but it all comes to us as a given. And I suppose right now the most evident matter about that is oil, that we live in a fossil-based economy, and now we're going to have a Secretary of State who basically is Secretary of Oil, and oil is a gift. It comes out of God's good earth, and we've managed to do many things with it, and we've managed to have many quarrels about it, but in the end, it is a gift, and if it were something that we ourselves could produce rather than receive as a gift, we wouldn't be scrambling so much to control those deposits of God's gift. And I think one can extrapolate from oil to many other resources that we manage to monetize, but in fact they are all inscrutable gifts of God's abundance.
So this view that money and possessions are a gift of God contradicts the market ideology in which there are no gifts, no free lunches. There are only payouts for adequate performance and production.
That's exactly right. And so that that kind of rationality creates an illusion of self-sufficiency, or the illusion that we can be self-made. And what it leads to is the assumption that my ownership of some part of these gifts is an absolute that cannot be questioned. It's mine. I made it. I own it. I can do what I want to with it, which is all a misunderstanding of how gifts operate. And that, as you know, right through my book, it seems to me that the Bible regularly challenges those uncriticized assumptions of our modern society.
And historically, you use the illustration of the Pharaoh.
Yes, I think Pharaoh is the paradigmatic case of assuming, as Pharaoh is quoted as saying in the book of Ezekiel, "I made the Nile, I own it," when in fact the Nile made him. Pharaoh assumes that he is entitled to all of the produce, all of the food, all of the natural resources, and he cannot recognize that they are all gifts of God for which he has important responsibilities. And I think that what's laid out so clearly in the Exodus narrative about Pharaoh continues so that in the parable in Luke about the man who builds bigger barns, it strikes me that he really is a replica of Pharaoh in the story of Jesus, but he, because he assumes that he is entitled to have more and more and should benefit from everything he can lay his hands on. And for that reason, Pharaoh and the Exodus deliverance stand at the very outset of gospel faith.
Now, your second thesis is that money and possessions are received as reward for obedience. Now, that's, of course, obedience to God. But there's also a kind of a dark side to that obedience, too, and that's what you call works righteousness.
That's right. That's a very tricky thesis because what the thesis wants to insist upon is that there is moral coherence between how we live and what we get. But it's very tricky because it can morph into pride and into condemnation of those whose life patterns have not led to wealth and security. But the point of the thesis is to insist that money belongs to a larger moral fabric, and therefore one must pay attention to how one lives and what one chooses, because one is choosing one's future. The Bible recognizes that that's a very tricky assumption, and the book of Job is basically a protest against it, because the character of Job has lived this very responsible, obedient life, and it has not turned out well for him. So the Bible knows that the thesis needs to be handled with considerable wisdom, and cannot be reduced to a simplistic calculus. But it is an insistence that you can't do anything with your life you want and expect to have it turn out all right. It matters how we live. It matters what we choose. It matters what we value. It matters what we share, because those are all future-creating gestures.
Now, sort of the counter position of that is that to view money and possessions as reward for obedience is too readily transposed into a reward system of the market, so that those who are productive should receive all the rewards and the system has to offer, even though the rewards often go to the productive, but to the well-advanced and the well-connected.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and you can see that in terms of the educational advantage that rich kids have, or the advantage in health care that rich people get. And those are not rewards of a covenantal system of obedience. They are rather the rewards of a manipulated economic system in which the powerful make the rules to their own benefit. And I think the chances are that the tax policies of the new Trump administration are going to do the same thing, which is why the market is so elevated. It is because very wealthy investors have the assumption that Trump is going to make it possible to earn a lot more money, and that money is going to come out of the pockets of vulnerable people, middle-class people, who do not have that kind of leverage. So it's an easy distortion, which then leads to the conclusion that I must have done something right because look how it's turned out for me. Obviously, the system is immensely open to manipulation, and I think that's what we got on our hands.
Now, your third thesis is that money and possessions belong to God and are held in trust by human persons in community.
Yeah, so that's a corollary of the first thesis, of course, that it's a gift and that it's held in trust. And if it's held in trust, then that means that the money and possessions entrusted to us need to be managed according to the intention of the giver. It's like any trustee in a bank has to follow the guidelines of the owner of the trust. And that means that with whatever money and resources we have, the ultimate theological question is, what is God's intention for this abundance with which God has entrusted us? And quite clearly, the God of the gospel intends, by the directives of the trust, that this wealth should be used for the common good of the neighborhood. And what happens as trustees is that we forget we are trustees and we come to think that we are owners, and then we are not subject to those kinds of intentions from God. So I think it's too much of a cliche to talk about trust and stewardship, but what it means is that we hold our wealth penultimately, and ultimately it is held by God. What we're finding out now with global warming, I suppose, is whether this all turns out to be a revocable trust. We have assumed that it's an irrevocable trust. We may be in process of watching it be revoked. We don't know yet.
Now, the converse of that is that to view money and possessions as a trust from God contradicts the pretension of market ideology that imagines, not unlike Pharaoh and the Nile, that my money is my own, I earned it, and can do with it what I want.
Exactly, exactly right. And the huge concentration of wealth in our current economy indicates that notion of it being all mine really leads to a kind of an idolatry of self-worth at the expense of everyone else.
Now, your fourth thesis is that money and possessions are sources of social injustice. When possessions are held in trust, they may be well managed according to the will of the owner, that is, for the sake of the neighborhood. But when possessions or money are viewed as mine without accountability, then they may be deployed in destructive ways at the expense of the common good.
Well, I think our current economic situation makes that all abundantly clear. What has happened to very much of our money interests is that it has no more interest in the common good, and all of that takes place under the guise of privatization, so that the Trump ideology is headed toward the privatization of everything it can, the privatization of health care, the privatization of schools. And what that means is that people who have economic resources have access to those matters, and people without economic resources do not have any access. So that really eventuates in the destruction of the common good. And I think we can see that particularly with what's happening to public schools. If you hear on radio the beguiling word of the Walton Family Trust, it says that they want to use a voucher system to give everybody a choice. What that really means is that the Walton Family Trust is committed to the destruction of public schools, and you can enumerate many fronts in which privatization is a decision against the common good that will inevitably leave more and more people behind. And I think that the whole covenantal understanding of money in the Bible has to do with the maintenance and the enhancement of the common good, common schools, common bridges and highways, common health care, all of the public funding that gives people access without regard to their wealth.
Your fifth thesis is that money and possessions are to be shared in a neighborly way. A core theme of biblical faith is that economic practice and policy must be ordered to serve the common good. As you said, the term neighbor means other members, that is, all members of the community, and later on you say both human and non-human members of the community.
I think that's right. When I was studying the Ten Commandments for this project, I paid great attention to the Tenth Commandment, which is a terse little commandment: thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not be acquisitive. And what struck me about that one verse in Exodus 20 is that it used the word neighbor three times. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife in a patriarchal society. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house. And then thou shalt not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. So the Ten Commandments ends in the tenth commandment with three uses of the word neighbor, 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 neighbor. And the market ideology that you and I have been talking about really eventuates in the judgment that there are no neighbors. There are only rivals and threats and competitors. The whole teaching of the Torah, that you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself, which Jesus identified then as one of the two great commandments, really has enormous economic implications. And the opposite of neighborliness in the Ten Commandments is coveting, that is, an endless predatory desire to confiscate what rightly belongs and is needed by other people. So that I think our society is in a crisis about the importance of neighborliness and the lack of restraint about acquisitiveness, which now goes under the flag of deregulation. Deregulation is an ideology that wants acquisitiveness to be practiced without restraint.
Now, your sixth thesis is that money and possessions are seductions that lead to idolatry. The Bible attests that money and possessions are not inanimate objects. They are rather forces of desire that evoke lust and love in a way that compels devotion and eventually servitude.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's not easy to get at, but I really learned from Jacques Ellul, the great French sociologist, that money is capable of having a demonic power that attracts us, and it turns out to be the case that when we have more money, we are propelled to want more money. It's easy to see in our society that money then can become the defining pursuit of one's life. And when it becomes the defining pursuit, then it has become an idol. And I think that the narrative about the golden calf in Exodus 32 is exactly an indication of it interests me that the calf, or in the Bible it's really a bull, is the symbol label of virility, and obviously gold means it's a precious commodity. So if you put virility and precious commodity together, you really have an alternative to the neighborly god, and it cannot be accidental that the icon in front of Wall Street is indeed a golden calf or a golden bull, so that we speak of a growth economy as a bull market, which means that it is invested with the kind of virility that lets us be on the make.
And the opposite of that, to view money and possessions as seductions that lead to idolatry, contradicts the market view that money and possessions are inert and innocent, neutral objects. The thesis might invite us to reconsider the quasi-religious passion of a consumer economy that is propelled by insatiable desire, in which we never have enough money or enough of the possessions that money makes possible. As any serious church leader knows, the one and only thing that is off limits for comment or critique is the money system and its military support that undergird the illusory well-being of our society.
I think that's right. I think that every pastor who thinks deeply about these matters knows two things. One, such a pastor knows that this stuff has to be talked about, and that this stuff, you can't dare talk about it. So that my experience in the church is you can critique all kinds of things. You can critique God, you can critique the Bible, you can critique the church, but you cannot touch the combination of U.S. militarism and U.S. capitalism. Those are indeed sacred icons that are invested with deep theological significance.
Thank you, Walter. Appreciate you illuminating your six theses of your new book, Money and Possessions, part of the interpretation series from Westminster John Knox Press. And I urge people to, of course, read the whole book. But to start, you can, and I hope we're not cheating, you can read the introduction and the preface and the foreword online, and that link will be in the show notes for this episode.
Well, thank you. I'm so grateful, Jerry, for the kind of work you do, because I think it is a practical, concrete implementation of the kinds of things that you and I have been talking about.
You've been listening to one part of my conversation with renowned biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann, talking about his recent book, Money and Possessions. Be sure to listen to the other part, too. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for several months and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive it by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've received lots of interesting responses, which you can read on simplelivingworks.org. Click on Recent Comments in window number 5 or see the link in the show notes. We've simplified our blogs for this year. The Weekly Nudge focuses only on the efforts of Simple Living Works. The Weekly Digest includes the latest posts from colleague organizations. Both come with a free subscription to our Simple Living Works blog. The much more complete, almost obsessively detailed monthly digest is now updated at least once a week and kept on the Simple Living Works site. Links to the monthly complete digest are given in both the Weekly Nudge and the Weekly Digest. We hope you'll check them out, but we don't want you to be overwhelmed by the amount of help available toward a life of simple living, which young adults now are inclined to call minimalism. As usual, I've lined up interesting thinkers and activists for this year for the podcast. It's time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to the podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in the earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live. Do not conform to the world. Be certain that better's not more. Contentment will transform your need, awakening what God has in store. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.